We are at this multi-layered intersection of astrophysics, humanities, identity, racial equity. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. She's one of the very few Black women to reach this level in her field. The world of theoretical physics is largely white, largely male. In the big mathematical questions about where we came from and the interconnectedness and order of all things, all means everyone, right? What about astrophysics do you find fascinating? Do you teach science or math? How do you encourage students of color in these fields? How do you make big questions of our universe accessible, inclusive? 800-642-1234. Chanda Prescott-Weinstein is an assistant professor of physics and core faculty member in women's studies at the University of New Hampshire. Her new book is called The Disordered Cosmos, A Journey into Dark Matter, Space-Time, and Dreams Deferred. Chanda, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thanks for having me, Kate.
Well, the subtitle, the two words, dreams deferred, that really gave me pause because I immediately thought of poet Langston Hughes and wonder, was there some interplay here with his What Happens to a Dream Deferred?
Yes. So Langston Hughes was the first poet that I really connected with as a child. And I would say that he just kind of looms large in the way that I think about the life that I have lived and the experience of being Black in America. And in fact, also one of the chapters, Let Astrophysics Be the Dream It Used to Be, is also a Langston Hughes reference. So it's, you're right on the nose. That's exactly what it is.
You know, that last line of that poem, or does it explode? And I'm just thinking about that line, about your science, about African Americans and the burden of how Black people have been treated in America. There is so much there to unpack.
Yeah, I have to say that this morning I'm thinking a lot about Dante Wright and his family and what's been happening in Minneapolis over the last 48 hours. And, you know, I've already had one conversation with a fellow Black cosmologist this morning. And in fact, he's from Wisconsin, Brian Nord. About how we're just going to get through the day, because we both have responsibilities to students and other people who are working with us that we have to keep doing science. And at the same time, you know, I think that we both just want to spend the day sitting and crying and just like trying to, you know, understand why there isn't enough action to stop killings like this from happening.
You helped organize this past June the strike for Black Lives. This was the walkout among more than 5,000 scientists and researchers to draw attention to systemic racism in the scientific community. What is the climate like for people of color who are working in your area in the sciences?
Yeah, the interesting thing about organizing the strike for Black Lives is the call was two parts. So one was that we were asking non-Black scientists to take at least a day to start thinking about and organizing themselves to change the material conditions under which Black people live. And this was a global call. It wasn't just in the United States. We asked people around the world to participate. And there were participants all over the world, so not just in the U.S. The second part of the call was to allow Black scientists to have the day to do whatever we wanted, to actually allow Black scientists a free day while everybody else took up the work of justice for Black people. And that goes back to what I was saying about, you know, coping in the aftermath of the killing of Dante Wright. And that, you know, again, this morning, I also opened up American Scientist magazine. My latest issue just arrived, and I'm the cover story. I have a cover story about dark matter on it, and so I'm having to kind of deal with this like very weird mix of I'm really excited to have my dark matter story on the cover. The cover image is a figure from a really important paper by a Taiwanese scientist, and I was really excited to have that on the cover. And at the same time, again, I'm dealing with these stressors. And the interesting thing about the strike was actually that people had a hard time understanding why we were calling for a day where Black people didn't have to worry about competing with the resources and the ability of non-Black people to focus while all of these things were happening. I hope people are starting to understand that now, that it's actually hard to do these things at the same time. And it is a skill set to be able to do both at the same time.
It's like you're in competing universes, two different universes, and trying to bridge that divide.
Yes. I think that we do live in two different universes. I think we are asked to by people who continuously tell us to be patient, to wait. You know, let's just talk about diversity and inclusion. And the more we talk about diversity and inclusion, the better it will get. But diversity and inclusion didn't save Dante Wright, and it wouldn't have saved Dante Wright. You know, and I'll just give a good example. The police officer who shot him, allegedly by accident, is a woman. So what did diversifying the police force do for Dante Wright? So we keep getting told to wait, and this basically situates us as having to live between two realities, one where we understand what is happening to Black people, and one where people tell us, you know, it'll get better at some point. And if you just chug along and get your PhD and get high grades, that, you know, magically people will treat you better. But Dante could have been Brian. Like, I just have to say that. Mm-hmm. Brian is an incredibly accomplished theoretical cosmologist at Fermi Lab. And those cops weren't interested in whether Dante had a PhD or not. Like, it's simply, PhDs will not save our lives. And as long as our colleagues and the people that we share this society with don't understand that those are the conditions under which we live, we are stuck living between two different worlds.
Chanda Prescott-Weinstein with us, author of the new book, The Disordered Cosmos, A Journey into Dark Matter, Space, Time, and Dreams Deferred. You can join in. Are you a person of color or a woman who works in the sciences? What barriers, what doubts did you face as you pursued your career? Do you find you're still having to prove yourself? 800-642-1234. Chanda, let's go back to your childhood growing up in East Los Angeles. Did you feel like your community, your teachers nurtured your abilities in math and science?
Yeah, I was very lucky that I was educated. I'm in Los Angeles Unified School District, and I spent grades 1 through 12 in magnet schools in the Los Angeles Unified School District. And so I was very lucky to be at schools that had resources that allowed them to focus on the students. My classes were way too large, so I don't want to say that the magnet system doesn't need more resources, but we were better off than my local schools in East LA. And so I was very, very lucky to have incredibly nurturing teachers who, for the most part, recognized early on that I was excited about math and supported me in that. I did have at least one racist teacher along the way, and I think I really benefited from the fact that I'm light-skinned, and so I think that I was, you know, I did better under having a teacher like that than I might have if I had been darker-skinned.
You explore how science offered you this sort of refuge from some of the world's ugliness. What was comforting about learning about science?
You know, when I was a kid, my parents are both political organizers. And so I grew up very conscious of things that were not right with the world. And so one of the things that seemed possible was that physics might be an escape from having to worry about everyday human problems. And obviously, as I've just been discussing, it didn't actually work out that way. But I think as a kid, it was an easy fantasy to have that I could worry about black holes and particle physics, and that I also had this hope and this optimism that knowing the answers to some of these deep questions, like the solution to the quantum gravity problem, might somehow point us in the right direction to solving some of our sociological problems. It was a very idealized situation, but I also completely I understand how I got there as a kid, and I understand why kids see it that way.
We have theoretical physicist Chanda Prasad Weinstein sharing wonders of the universe and putting pressure on her discipline to create more equality. Are you a scientist? How do you see racism, see sexism, discrimination affecting your profession? What would it mean if the sciences were more inclusive? What questions do you have about what scientists know about the formation of the universe? Join in 800-642-1234. Back in a minute here on the Ideas Network. Here with us for the morning show, I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We're learning from a particle cosmologist who works to make the universe more understandable, more inclusive of all people who ask why. Does dark matter or neutron stars baffle you? Are you a woman of color in a field where you have few allies? What has your professional journey been like? How was your view of science shaped by your upbringing? Join in 800-642-1234. The book is called The Disordered Cosmos, and University of New Hampshire physicist Chanda Prasad Weinstein is our guide. Chanda, let's dive into the science a little bit. You know, to some of us lay people, dark matter feels very mysterious, a bit scary, very far off. How might it be better for us to understand what dark matter is?
Word, it's interesting how many negative associations that we have with the word dark, right? Mm-hmm. And there's, I think, first of all, like a lot to unpack there, particularly in the context of a society for the last few hundred years has tended to treat people who are darker worse, right? Mm-hmm. But it's also kind of, it's not a good name, dark matter, for the phenomenon that we were talking about, because actually light goes right through it. So it should really be called invisible matter or transparent matter or clear matter. And I'll give people like a thought experiment. If you're not driving while you're listening to this show, then you can do this along with me. Just hold out your hands and put them together. So cup them together and imagine that someone puts a clump of dark matter in your hands. So okay. This isn't really possible as far as we know, but imagine someone puts a clump of dark matter in your hands. So what you will feel is your hands will feel weighted down, right? Mm-hmm. Because the dark matter will be attracted to the earth through gravitation. And so you will feel like there's something that has some mass to it, some weight to it in your hands. But when you look at your hands, they will look exactly the way that they do right now. Because light will be going right through it. So you can just walk around now. This can be like your little, like, you know, playing with your, like having, testing out your imagination, like as if a child would. And you can just hold out your hands. You're carrying some dark matter around. Just pretend that there's some weight to it. So of course, when you think about the phrase dark matter, you think that if somebody puts a clump of dark matter in your hands will be obscured, right?
Mm-hmm.
That's what comes to mind, but that's not how that works. So, you know, the history of why it's called dark matter is a very interesting one. And it's such a reminder that, you know, there's always a social side to what's happening in physics, because there's the actual phenomenon where the universe is just doing what the universe is doing. And then, you know, there's what we call it.
Well, you know, I want to ask you about the late great astronomer Carl Sagan, who is, you know, he's been described as like the gatekeeper of scientific credibility. Ordinary people would write to him at Cornell with all their big ideas, their fringe ideas about the universe. How do you view Sagan's legacy?
So I think that Sagan played a really important role in cementing the idea that scientists had a responsibility to communicate with the general public.
Hmm.
He did that really, really excellently, I believe. He was, of course, imperfect, and I have heard stories about how he was sometimes not great in his relationships with women. But he also played a very important role in encouraging the general public to see themselves as part of the conversation about why we care about the history of the universe. And I think he really put a very special message out there, which was that we are simultaneously like very small and in some ways insignificant as like individual like apes walking around a tiny little planet around a pretty like average star. And at the same time, we're really precious because we evolved at all and we are all unique in some way. And I think that that's a really powerful way of looking at our location in the universe, both physically and socially. And it's been very influential for me.
I was going to say, this sounds a lot like how you lead your life.
Yes. I will say that I read the book Cosmos at least three or four times when I was an undergrad. And part of that was I felt like there was a very big disconnect between the experience that I was having in my physics classes, primarily, not so much in my astronomy classes, but really in my physics classes, and what excited me about physics and astronomy. And it was Sagan's Cosmos that kept me focused on what mattered and why it mattered to me. And then later, when I read his final essay collection, Billions and Billions, where he really takes the time to think through what is the human condition and what world is he leaving behind, because he wrote this as he was dying. That for me, I read Billions and Billions and said, I want to have this kind of message for people that we can do better, that there is something to be hopeful for, that there is something to be optimistic about, and that we are worth fighting for, but that does mean that we have to fight.
And how did he describe his daughter at his death? What did he say?
So I'm probably paraphrasing a little bit, but the way that I remember it is that he said, Sasha, beautiful Sasha, you are enormous, gorgeous.
Enormous, and gorgeous,
really love the phrase enormous, gorgeous. And I think like the other important thing there was like a reminder that, you know, language is something that you're allowed to play with and experiment with.
If you're just joining us, we have Chanda Prasad Weinstein, author of The Disordered Cosmos, A Journey into Dark Matter, Space, Time, and Dreams Deferred. You can join in with your questions about the universe, about being a woman scientist, about being a physicist or a cosmologist, thoughts on dark matter, on quarks, 800-642-1234. Chanda, let's talk a moment here about the Big Bang. You write that many scientists now think that there may not have been a single Big Bang that started the universe. What are the theories that are out there?
Yeah, this is a pretty interesting thing, because even the way that we use the phrase Big Bang has changed over time within the physics community. So I think that often the general public understands it as you know, this moment when the universe first came into existence. And I think sometimes we can have kind of this like cartoon idea of it, that it was like an explosion that happened at one point in space. But really a better way of thinking about that version of events is that it is an explosion that happened everywhere at the same time, rather than thinking of like something going off in one place, that it actually went off everywhere in the universe at the same time. Now, often when we use the term Big Bang actually in our research, we often mean a little bit later, when particles start to evolve and start to interact with each other. And this is often referred to as the hot Big Bang.
Yeah.
Before the hot Big Bang happens, there's something called cosmic inflation. So we're pretty sure there's a little bit of disagreement, I will acknowledge, but I would say there's fairly widespread consensus that something called cosmic inflation happened, where for a very tiny, tiny, tiny fraction of a second, so 10 to the minus 41 or so seconds, the universe's space-time expanded exponentially. So if you've thought about economic inflation, it's kind of like that, except we really don't want this kind of inflation. And it turns out that most of the models of cosmic inflation that make sense actually suggest that there are potentially multiple bubbles of space-time that are continuously forming. And so it's possible that our universe is just one bubble out of an infinite set of bubbles of space-time.
That's crazy.
Yeah.
So how do physicists study that or even get the mathematical modeling right around the space-time?
So I will say, actually, the math is easy. I mean, I'll air quote that in case like any of my colleagues are listening. Like, that's really hard, Chanda. Chanda, what are you talking about? I would say, from my point of view as a theoretical physicist, experimental physics is the hard thing to do. And the theory is a lot easier because we get to idealize things. We ignore physical features that we think aren't salient, that we don't have to worry about. The hard part is testing these ideas and figuring out which one is the correct model. Mm. And so the race is really on to figure that out in cosmology. And there's a real debate that's happening right now about the extent to which we will be able to test some of these ideas, particularly if we are in a bubble, you know, if we live in a true bubble, how can we possibly know about other bubbles if we don't have any contact with them, right? Mm. Is there observational evidence for that? And so there are experimental cosmologists who are working really hard to look for evidence of that. We don't have it yet. And so this is one of the reasons why there continues to be disagreement about whether inflation is the best model.
We have to pause right there with Chanda yes. Prescott Weinstein here on the Ideas Network. We're exploring the universe without judgment here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. The book is called The Disordered Cosmos. And when particle cosmologist Chanda Prescott Weinstein describes her work, she goes into the history of space-time, as we've been talking about, the biggest picture there is. And she writes, it feels like being the keeper of a deeply human impulse, a griot of the universe, a storyteller. How do you tell the stories of your scientific discipline? Is your ability to describe your work in clear, non-jargony ways the key to making more people excited about your research? If science were more inclusive, what would that mean for discovery? Join in 800-642-1234. The University of New Hampshire's Chanda Prescott Weinstein is with us for the hour. We were talking there about the bubble theory and, you know, viewing the universe having expanded exponentially in the first, you know, teeny tiny fraction of a second after the Big Bang. Can you pick up for us on our universe's birth and how the race is on in your field to figure this out?
Yeah, you know, the interesting thing about the arguments that go on about inflation are really, in some sense, centered on whether we have enough evidence to believe that it occurred. And there are all sorts of kind of interesting borderline philosophical questions here about what constitutes sufficient empirical evidence for a model before you determine that it's correct. And so I would say that, again, the majority of the community continues to believe that this exponential expansion occurred. But, you know, there's a vocal minority that has been writing in the pages of Nature and in Scientific American and elsewhere that they simply don't think that the evidence is there. So, you know, I think it's a really great example of when we talk about what science is and what science does, that science exists at the boundary of what humanity knows and what humanity doesn't know. And so it's quite normal for us to be arguing with each other. And so science isn't just a collection of facts. It's actually a process where we are trying to build consensus and come to agreement about exactly what data do we need and do we have enough of it.
I understand you're a fan of Star Trek. And when you talk about yes. you know, finding consensus on what we know and don't know, it seems like all the answers were neat and tidy in Star Trek. What attracts you to Star Trek?
Yeah, you know, I think the interesting thing about that is that the Star Trek franchise has evolved on that point. Hmm. Like, it's certainly the case that the original series was very episodal. And that's a reflection of how television was made in the late 1960s. And, you know, it's worth saying also that the first series only got a couple of seasons run before it was canceled. And it really kind of took off later as a cartoon and then as a film series and then was revived with The Next Generation. And again, The Next Generation was also very episode focused. And so things had to be tied up neatly. When you look at what happened with the next series in the franchise. So specifically with Deep Space Nine and then Voyager, you start to see these multi-story arcs where things don't get wrapped up immediately. So Voyager spends 7 years right out in the wrong part of the galaxy trying to figure out how they can possibly get home. And they're trying to solve the problem and they don't succeed for 7 years, right? This is a scientific, it's an engineering problem that they're trying to solve. Similarly, in Deep Space Nine, they're grappling with how do we address the wounds of a society that has survived slavery and colonialism. And, you know, just to give context for the time, it was around the time that the Troubles were finally coming to an end in Ireland. And I'll just say right now that I hope that they continue to stay at an end, right? I think there's a real threat there. But these shows started to grapple with these challenges in a way that was very reflective of everyday life. And I think we see that also in Discovery, that the latest Star Trek series, that they're dealing with problems that are hard to solve and don't get solved in 45 minutes.
Yeah.
So I think Star Trek has evolved on that point.
Let's bring in Alan in Augusta. Alan, hi. What would you like to add about the Big Bang?
Actually, you guys just stirred me with talking about Star Trek, especially Star Trek Voyager. Actually, it's sad. SGU was canceled after two seasons, I think, between a combination of MGM going bankrupt and low viewership on two, because season one was too much like Battlestar Galactica because they didn't have control of the ship yet. And then the second season was absolutely phenomenal. But I guess I would have to say that I actually disagree with your multiple bang across the whole universe. I had actually watched two shows in concurrent. They were actually scheduled back to back. One was the biggest, one was the smallest. Of course, the biggest, the end, was the universe. And the end of the smallest was the bang that happens in a particle accelerator. And after watching those shows, I came up with my own theory that, and it also poses a question, which came first, the universe or the particle accelerator? And in essence, we are all subatomic particles, because our galaxy is a subatomic particle. Our solar system is a subatomic particle. Our planet's a subatomic particle, which makes us, which scurry around on it, a subatomic particle.
Well, let's get Chanda to weigh in on this. Go ahead.
You know, I think the comment I will always make to people when they think they have a good theory is, if you can work it out and compare it with the data and convince people it's a good model, more power to you.
There you go. Let's bring in Ross now from Middleton. Ross, hi.
Hi, good morning, you guys. So I'm a 60-year-old guy. But, you know, the University of Wisconsin here at Madison has a program, I think it's been going on for a number of years, called Science is Fun, run by a chemistry professor, Dr. Shakashiri. And he brings in, I don't know, young kids. I don't even think they're high school. I think they're mostly elementary. And they just sort of do this play acting and incorporate science. And I think it would gather no female of any background. I don't really know how successful it is. How many of those kids that thought they were going to become plumbers ended up becoming scientists? So it's a program, and it seems pretty cool. It's even fun as an adult to watch. The question I was going to ask is, I took science when I was younger. I went to college, and I never understood this space-time slowing and speeding. I think if I go from point A to point B in my car, it's a distance. If I drive 30 miles an hour, I drive 60 miles an hour. It seems like I get there faster. I still don't. How do you try to grasp this concept that time slows down or time speeds up?
That's a great question, Ross. Chanda.
Yeah, I think the question of how you gain intuition for physics that describes, you know, conditions that aren't part of our everyday life is an interesting one. And it's one, you know, I will say that there's probably, it's fair to describe it as a raging debate in physics education research about the best way to introduce students to concepts that are outside of everyday life. And you know, it's one of those things where you spend a lot of time sitting with it and thinking about it, and you develop an intuition as you work through it. So I think it's like any other problem in life, that the only way out is through. And so the thing that I'm always telling my students is that you have to, you know, solve problems. That said, maybe I can give you a little bit of a thought experiment for having an intuition for the expansion of space-time. So I'm going to have everyone who can safely do this. So please, if you're driving, please focus on the road. But if you can just imagine a balloon that's not blown up. So it's this one, you bought a bag of balloons, you take one out, you get like a permanent marker, and you put dots all over it. So give them a little bit of space between them. And then blow up the balloon. Just do this in your head. As you blow up the balloon, now pretend that these were like very special dots, so the dots aren't going to expand as you're blowing the balloon up. But what you'll notice is that the distance on the balloon between the dots has grown, right?
Yeah.
So you wouldn't say that the dots ran away from each other or are driving away from each other, right? What you would say is that the balloon expanded between the two dots, right? Any two dots that you're looking at. That's a pretty good analogy for what's happening with space-time and with galaxies in space-time, is that the space-time between galaxies is expanding. And so the galaxies stay together because gravity is holding them together, but space-time between them is expanding. And so, you know, the interesting thing is that you probably can't use your everyday intuition for physics to give you intuition for that, but you can look for other analogies. For example, this balloon with the magic permanent marker dots on it. And I find that one to be a really useful thing. And so far it's worked on my students. So maybe that will help you a little bit.
I would imagine that you try to think up a lot of analogies for these functions, these concepts, in order to really make this science tangible.
Yes, as much as possible. I think sometimes it's important to realize that there are certain details that aren't going to be accessible until people have had an opportunity to grapple with some more basic concepts. And I think that that's one of the challenges that we face in communicating science with the public. And at the same time, I think that we need to be thoughtful in our assumptions about what is intuitive to people. So we have this tendency to tell people that what's intuitive for them is what we call like everyday life physics. But what that really means is culturally bound and contextual. Like I remember once when I was a graduate student, I was administering an exam that I hadn't written. And the exam had a problem that referred to football on it. And I was in Canada and it referred to American football. I was in Canada and I was at a university that was actually majority or had a significant percentage of international students who were not from North America. And I spent a lot of the exam time answering students' questions about football so that they could answer the problem, right? And I actually see that as like a massive pedagogical fail, that whoever had written the problem had just assumed that everybody would have an intuition for how things happen in football, right?
Yeah.
And there I was, as someone who didn't really watch football, trying to answer these questions. And I think the other example I'll just give on this point is that we tend to think of quantum mechanics, the idea that something can be a particle and a wave at the same time, this wave-particle duality. We teach that, I will say we as a community, this isn't how I would teach it. We tend to tell students that this is not intuitive and that they just have to accept it and that it's weird. But I also know that I've heard at least one non-binary person, Amru Al-Qadi, who's a British drag queen, actually talk about how their non-binary identity makes sense when you think about the fact that particles are also non-binary. And for me, that really raises the question, like, maybe quantum wave particle duality is only not intuitive for people who are really invested in the gender binary. Like, what if you liberate yourself from that kind of antiquated idea? Then maybe it doesn't seem so wild or strange that something could be two things at the same time.
Theoretical physicist Shonda Prescott-Weinstein with us, and she says particle physics often feels like the gift that keeps on giving, because just when you think you've come to understand it, there's another layer. Who was your role model and encourager on your path to becoming a scientist? Have you found colleagues and collaborators in your discipline? How have you seen your scientific community expand, become more inclusive? Still time to talk, 800-642-1234. Back in a minute on the Ideas Network. It's the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Let's get back to our conversation with University of New Hampshire particle cosmologist Chanda Prescott Weinstein. We're exploring her vision of the universe, big questions grounded in Black feminist traditions. She views herself as one natural conclusion of a Black child dreaming of quarks. Her place in the academy, informed by her upbringing by a single mom who struggled financially and Los Angeles public school teachers who, she says, made her a, quote, student of the universe. And Chanda is with us for 10 more minutes. Chanda, we heard from Lyric from Blanchardville, called in, couldn't stay with us. And Lyric wonders, what advice would you have for Wisconsin education officials about how to improve teaching science and math for students of color, for diverse students?
You know, I think that this is a really interesting question because there's just been a lot of discussion about this. And, you know, the first thing that I want to urge people to do is educate themselves about the history of science and then start teaching true histories of science, because often the way that science is taught, that there are little casual historical remarks along the way, like, oh, Isaac Newton came up with this or Albert Einstein came up with this. I didn't learn in elementary school that Onesimus, an enslaved Black man who had been kidnapped from Africa, was the one who introduced inoculations to the New England settlers who were facing smallpox in the 17th century. And, you know, when we talk about vaccines and context now, right, it's actually, I think, pretty important to say that the history of concepts on that spectrum actually begin, in some sense, in the colonial United States, actually with African knowledge. I wish I could say more about where in Africa that knowledge came from, but unfortunately, you know, part of the devastation of slavery and colonialism is that we often that information has been erased. That gives us a very different vision of who has been doing science and where scientific knowledge has come from. And I think that that's a really important thing, is to get away from this idea that science is something that people of color have never done before, and that we are newly being introduced to science thanks to, you know, Europeans and Americans who are socializing us into it. But that in fact, a lot of scientific knowledge originates with communities from the global majority. And I think it's important for children to know that, and to know that early on, and to have a sense of seeing themselves in this great cosmological scientific story. And I don't think that that is integrated into the curriculum or not at this point. So I think that that is really important. And then I think the other thing is that there has to be very active effort to teach children, particularly from backgrounds that are historically marginalized, that just because people have been saying that people like them can't do something doesn't mean that they can't do it. So in my particular case, by the time I was 6 years old, I knew who Harriet Tubman was. I knew who Sojourner Truth was. One of my middle names is, in fact, Sojourner Truth, or is Sojourner. I'm after Sojourner Truth. And that meant that from a very early age, I understood that there were Black people, Black women, who had been told that there were things that they were not allowed to do because they were Black, and then they went and did them anyway. I understood that that was part of my heritage and my cultural tradition. And I think that it can give children the confidence to look at a situation where they don't see a lot of people like them and say, okay, I see that there's been a barrier, but just because there's been a barrier doesn't mean I can't climb over it or break it entirely.
I want to ask you about a Hebrew prayer, the close of your book, The Traveler's Prayer, that asks for a safe journey, beginning and ending your book. And, you know, you're a Reconstructionist Jew, a more progressive sect of Judaism. How does your Jewish identity inform your life and your work as a physicist?
I want to acknowledge that my rabbi, Rabbi Toba Switzer, is the one who suggests that I end the traveler's prayer. And so I think as like a really good example, I called Rabbi Toba and I was like, I know that we start and end everything with a prayer, but I'm not sure what prayers I should start and end with. I think the Shehecheyanu for the beginning. And she was the one who said, start with the Ma'ariv, the prayer for the evening, because you're talking so much about the night sky. And then why not go with a traveler's prayer? Because you're sending people often to the world on to continue on in this journey of understanding the cosmos and bringing justice to the world, which is a central tenet for our congregation. And so I think that my values as a Jewish person are just weaved throughout the book, particularly the concern with, you know, welcoming the stranger or the sojourner, as it is known in some translations of the Torah. And also the idea that it is our responsibility to make the world whole, to bring justice into the world. That for me, these are all very Jewish viewpoints on what our responsibility in the world is and what our role is. And even in the optimism and believing that if we take on that task, we might be able to succeed in it.
You know, you send so many students off into the world and really try to make an impact on their lives and their journey through science discovery, through their careers. What has it been like for you as a professor in these pandemic times?
You know, it's very hard to know what the best thing is every day. And I think that being a scientist often involves living with uncertainty because you often don't know if your research is going in the right direction, if you've messed up a calculation, or anything like that. And so on the one hand, you might feel like, okay, you're prepared to deal with this uncertainty. But on the other hand, the stakes have never been so high in my career that I have to worry about the emotional well-being of my students. I have to ask myself, you know, do I want to push them a little bit to focus on science, or is that pushing in the wrong direction? On the other hand, if I leave them to their own devices, are they just going to end up spiraling in ways that are unhealthy for them? It's been a really difficult time. I've been really lucky to be in a very supportive Department of Physics and Astronomy at the University of New Hampshire, where I think the concern for students really comes first, and the concern for the safety of students and faculty has really come first. And as much as we've been allowed to, I'm concerned for the safety of graduate students and staff as well, although there are restrictions on what we as a department can do about that. I'm so grateful that I had my first shot on Friday last week. And I just want to encourage everyone out there, when you have access to your vaccine, please go get it.
Oh, we only have a few seconds left, but, you know, do you find hope at the end of this pandemic? Do you see that we're going to be able to overcome this?
I believe, as Maria Makaba says, that hope is a practice. And even on the days when I don't feel that faith, it's my responsibility to practice that faith. And I think I keep going for the most part because I do believe that possibility is out there, and we have to fight for what is possible because it won't happen if we don't try.
Chanda, thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Chanda Prescott Weinstein teaches physics and gender studies at the University of New Hampshire. Her new book is called The Disordered Cosmos, A Journey into Dark Matter, Space-Time, and Dreams Deferred. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. This is The Morning Show, and you're listening to the Ideas Network.